Hello and welcome to Black Gold, a five-part series that digs deep through the 3CR archive to present Black Gold. My name's Kerry Lee Harding and I'm the producer of the series. Each episode was created right here in the studios of 3CR Community Radio on Wurundjeri land in Fitzroy, Melbourne, together with assistant producer Corey Green. Throughout the Black Gold series, we'll take you from the 1970s through to the present day, with a look at how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander broadcasters at 3CR covered some incredible community events and significant political struggles. We'll attend a land rights meeting in 1978, celebrate the life of broadcaster Lisa Belair, and hear about the success of the campaign to save Northland Secondary College. We'll also reflect back on the anti-bicentenary actions in 1988 and get up to date with the ongoing struggle for sovereignty and treaty. Just a warning to all our listeners, you will hear voices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have passed. And now, episode 4 of the Black Gold series, we celebrate the life of Lisa Belair with presenter Viv Malo.
Hi, I'm Viv Malo, host of the Black Block radio show on 3CR. Coming up in this program, you'll hear archival interviews with the late 3CR broadcaster, Sister Lisa Belair. First up, you'll hear some poetry reading, followed by audio of an interview with Lisa that was featured on the 3CR community radio program Women on the Line with host Ruth Barney.
Lucky Country, and this is by Dennis Fisher, Den the Fish. Who owns this country? Where do they come from? Are they Australians? Are they Poms? What did they bring here? What do they speak? Do they speak English? Do they speak Greek? They bring trouble. They bring guns. Shoot you dead, you're nothing but a bum. They say you're a no-hoper. You no good. You just nothing. You just a boom. Where can we go? Where can we stay? Stand up and fight. Kneel down and pray. We have to do something. We have to together. We can't do it alone. We can make it better. So come on, you people. Let's come as one. Bring your family, children, dad and mum. Bring all your friends. Bring all your relations. This is what we call reconciliation. And it's Den the Fish.
Just because, you know, you were adopted and fostered and you were brought up by white people and, you know, you might have gone to private school, you might have even had a pony. These are some of the stereotypes. And you might even learn to ski. That's another stereotype. Destiny says blacks don't ski. Okay, I put my hand up, but I was adopted, you know, and I'm starting to feel ashamed about that. But there's still that pain that you go through. I mean, nothing that all these material things cannot make up for the loss of not being brought up with your family. And when I met up with my, you know, some more of my relations, like, I've got hundreds of relations, but I've got family right around Australia too. That's white family and that's my Indigenous family, because there's some, you know, white people that look out for me too. I just cried. I just couldn't deal with it. I just looked around, you know, all this family, and I just, for that split second, I know I shouldn't have, but I couldn't help it. I just kept thinking, I missed out on this.
Lisa Belair is one of the stolen generations of Aboriginal children, and today on Women on the Line, she tells her story. Hello, I'm Ruth Barney. Lisa was one of the contributors to Breaking Through, Women, Work and Careers, edited by Jocelyn Scott. In Breaking Through, Lisa writes, "Since the invasion, one in six Aboriginal children has been removed from their natural family. I was one of those victims. Because of the support and love of some close friends who are more like family, I can now call myself a survivor." Adopted as a baby by a white family in 1961, Lisa grew up not knowing that she was Aboriginal. Later, on the pretext of getting a better education, she was sent to boarding school. The real reason, says Lisa, is that she was being sexually abused by her adoptive father. Incredibly, Lisa has overcome these odds to speak out about and work for the rights of Indigenous people in Australia. As a teenager, Lisa says she was inspired by then-Senator Susan Ryan and her outspokenness on women, Aboriginals and education. She says, I told myself if I stuck at school, attended university, I would be able to work for Susan Ryan in Canberra. Today, Lisa works as the Aboriginal Liaison Officer at Melbourne University and broadcasts on 3CR and 3LO in Melbourne. She's been active in Aboriginal theatre and education and did a stint as a councillor for Collingwood Council. This is Lisa's story.
My mum came down from the north coast of New South Wales, probably 1960, round about then, came down to Melbourne, to Carlton. Actually, she had a job at the Postmaster General, PMG, as it used to be called, the old post office, which was also very unusual for a Koori woman, well, a Koori person, to actually have a government job back in those days. And she met my dad. I mean, the story's a bit hazy there. And at the time, because she worked, I was in Berry Street Babies Home, East Melbourne. And I guess some of the listeners would be aware then, but, you know, back in the 1960s, could even be before then, you actually paid to have your child minded in Berry Street as opposed to its role now. But in addition to the payment, you signed a document which said that if payment fell in arrears by 4 weeks, then automatically you became a ward of the state. Now, what happened, my mum got really sick. She went home to Lismore in New South Wales. And again, you know, we've got to look at the big picture. And during the 1960s, like, I was born in 1961, but preceding that, where the federal government and the state government had an official policy of assimilation, okay? Assimilation, which spelt out in quite detail that Aboriginal people were to become Australian citizens. Here we are talking about assimilation, and we didn't even receive citizenship till 1967. I guess there's a bit of irony in there. So that you had government instrumentalities, example, for the police that would go into Aboriginal people's homes and take children. You had the social workers who played an active role. And you also had things like with my circumstances, how my mum got sick. She went home, and when she was in hospital, of course, she didn't receive medical care with everybody else because she was a Koori. So she was treated in the basement of the hospital, and I don't know the type of care that she received. She wrote a will saying I was to go to my grandmother, and she died. But before she died, a letter got sent to her saying, well, this will isn't recognised because it wasn't signed by a justice of the peace. So in order for me to go home, we need two airfares and adequate winter clothing, so that if, you know, my grandmother, who was raising eight other children, had money for two airfares, then there was adequate winter clothing. And, you know, good question, Ruth, what does adequate winter clothing mean? So it was sort of like, I look at the big picture. It's important to do that in order to try and make sense of what's gone on in this country. And years ago, like, I couldn't even talk about what we're talking about. Like, I do cry. Like, sometimes I'll be in my room, or I'll be walking around the streets because I still don't drive it and have my Ray-Bans on. And you just think about things that you don't necessarily think about. You, the only time that I really consciously sort of think about, you know, because you can't be thinking, well, gosh, what if we didn't have assimilation? You know, what if white people didn't invade our country? You know, what if this was a sexist-free, racist-free society? You know, what if, I mean, all I know is what I've gone through. All I know is how I've reacted to that, how angry that I have been in my life. When I was younger, I didn't do things like slash myself. I didn't do things like some Kooris would do, and that's, you know, put acid on their skin to make themselves white, or they'd get steelo wool and scrub their skin. You know, this is all stuff that's happened to Kooris, to Aboriginal people, to Torres Strait Islanders that have been, you know, taken away, fostered, adopted, put in orphanages. It was all supposed to make us good citizens of this country, you know, one nation. And not everyone can speak out on these issues, and it's very painful for me, but it's something that I have an obligation to Australian society, you know, to at least say to people out there, look, please listen, please try and understand. It's no good saying I wasn't here in 1788, but look around what's gone on in more recent history. Look what's gone on, you know, in the 1930s, the 1950s, the 1960s, and we're here in the 1990s. I think everyone wants to be proud of this country, but in order to be proud of whatever it means to be Australian, we've got to acknowledge what's gone on to the Indigenous community in this country.
Well, like you say, you, like so many other Aboriginal children, were taken away from your family and actually adopted out to a white family.
Yeah, and the thing with me, I was told that I was Polynesian. And so when I used to experience a lot of the racism at school, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it'd be good to be like an outsider and say, well, that's a fascinating experience that, you know, Case LB went through. You know, she was Koori, but she was brought up that she was Polynesian, and what effect did that have on her psyche and her personal development? You know, I can't stand that sort of approach. And I had to go through, like, I mean, when people would call me things like Abbo, Boon, Coon, when I'd get bashed up in the schoolyard for being black, like, I used to think, well, I'm Polynesian. Or I was told that I was Scottish. Well, you know, my adoptive parents, my adoptive father was Scottish, and my adoptive mother was actually born in Waterford in Ireland. And then there was me, and I had an adoptive brother too, which doesn't get mentioned in the story, so this is, you know, for you. And he was white Australian and 4 years older than me, and I'd like to be in contact with him, but I've got to do some research there. So it wasn't until later on in life that I officially found out that I wasn't Polynesian. So I used to get given books and told that, you know, my grandmother was a Polynesian princess, and get books on Hawaii. And at one stage, my adoptive parents were going to move to New Zealand because they said, well, you know, you're Polynesian, and so that means, you know, Maori.
Did they actually know that you were a Koori?
Well, again, you know, I mean, people say that I'm too kind and I'm too generous. That's something that I always want to maintain regardless of wherever I end up, and I'm sure I've got enough aunties and uncles and cousins and friends and people like you that'll keep me on the track, you know, and just sort of say, look, Blair, remember who you are. That when I got my file from Community Services, that was in 1986, that's Community Services of Victoria, when Destiny Deacon, that is, you know, we'd had discussions about, look, you've got to know who you are. And I mean, I knew that, but I was that scared because one of the things is I had prejudices. I was racist, and I'll admit that, you know. So when I mix with, say, white people and they feel uncomfortable about, you know, racism and, you know, how can I understand Aboriginal people? Well, you know, how can they ever understand an Indigenous person having racism towards other Indigenous people? Now, I know about internalised oppression and internalised racism now. I mean, and going to America really helped me understand what that meant. But prior to that knowledge, I had to work through so much anger. I had to work through my fears because all I knew about Koori people in this country was what I read in the newspapers, what I saw on television, what I heard on the radio, if there was anything on the radio. And predominantly, you know, it tended to be either a success story, and usually a sporting success story. Of course, I'm not saying anything against our fine athletes, who I admire, many of them, or it would be the Aboriginal problem. And there, you know, and there was me. I didn't mix with any people that everyone that I mixed with was white, you know. I couldn't go home and talk about racism. I couldn't go home. Like, I can't explain this. All I know is that when I used to get bashed up because of people thinking that I was different, you know, and an Aboriginal person, I couldn't go home to my adoptive parents. I don't know why I couldn't go home and say, hey, I got dashed up because someone called me black. I protected myself, and so I didn't see myself as black.
Lisa's file said she was either Chinese, Malay or possibly Polynesian. She writes in Breaking Through, "When I first had the courage to go to the Department of Community Services Victoria Adoption Information Service with my friend Destiny, I was given my old file. Occasionally I'm capable of pulling it out from its hiding place. I go through it and still cannot believe that the file is about me, about my life. I can't even use my adoptive name. It makes me so very sad. I was made a ward of the state, then adopted into a white family. I tried to survive. It inspired me to fight for social justice and become keenly involved in the media."
As soon as I saw my file, I knew the name, because the Belair name is known throughout Australia and throughout the world, actually. It's just one of those names, like you could mention other names, Atkinson, for example, and people now, that's most likely going to be a Koori person at the end of the microphone. So, you know, Belair's one of those names. And I'd seen my relations on TV before, but I didn't know that they were my relations. All I knew is that they'd made an impact on me.
So was that a really painful journey for you to have to set about discovering your family?
Well, like I said, I had a family down here. Like, you know, we're not talking about my adopted family, but the Koori community down here in Victoria, I mean, like, because so many people have been gone through my experience that, and they realise that not everyone, you know, can find their family. When some people will reach out for their family when they're five, you know, because they get caught shops lifting, and then someone from the authorities goes in and says, well, you know, why is this person stealing? And other people are too frightened. Like, I know people that are in their 20s, and I know people in their 50s that don't. That are just so scared of what they might find out, or maybe they're ashamed or whatever, but they've been accepted by people down here, you know. I mean, ultimately, I want everyone to come home. I want every Indigenous person, every Black person, you know, in this country to come home and to find their family. But it was very, very painful. I had a support base. It was that support base of Destiny, Janina, Johnny, Harding, Eleanor Harding, that enabled me to have the strength, which meant that I could go to community services. I mean, it wasn't an easy decision. I mean, we fought. I mean, we literally grabbed each other and swore at one another, got physically violent towards one another, because I was resisting. Like, I knew what I had to do, but I was terrified. Now I've made that transition, and Destiny says to me, Lisa, I guess you're ready to go through a lot of what you're going through now. And that's true, you know, which goes back to not thinking how life might have been. You know, I can't afford to do that, because I have to think, well, okay, so many things have gone on in my life. What contribution can I make to society? How can society benefit from this travesty of justice? But how can I also look after myself as well?
And so how did your family feel when they did meet you? Because they, like your grandmother and your uncles, they must have known that you were out there somewhere but had no way of contacting you.
One of the when we contacted community services, my Auntie Kay and Uncle Bob had already written a letter to Community Services Victoria saying that, you know, if ever Lisa contacted the department, it used to be Social Welfare Department then, for them to, you know, for me to contact them and then to contact them. And so with the adoption laws, the Victorian adoption information laws are the most, progressive in Australia. And I say that as an Indigenous person, but someone that's used the processes as well. And because I'd contacted them and there was this letter saying, please, if Lisa contacts, then we met up within 5 days, but for sometimes people the wait could be 2 years or 5 years. And my uncle Bob, he's a barrister, he was in court, so he as soon as he ran out, he rang, you know, like he got the message, and then he left his case. Well, I mean, he went back to it, but he just sort of come out when he had a break, and we talked. Then I went up to Sydney and met my grandmother, because my Auntie Kay and Uncle Bob, they've dealt with lots of kids that have gone through what I've gone through before, even though they hadn't actually gone through this with their oldest. Like, I'm the oldest of 21st cousins, right? So that was sort of more, you know, more closer to home. And so I stayed with them in North Bondi for a few days. I met my grandmother who was there, and she had had a box of receipts. And if you recall, I mentioned that at Berry Street, you know, one of the clauses was if payment fell in arrears 1 month or more. Well, my grandmother had kept up the payments. That made me sad.
It must have made you very angry as well.
Anger isn't something that I'm conscious of. I know that I've got the capability of anger, but it isn't something that I go around seething and being conscious of my anger. I just felt this society is... It's got to change. Mm.
To me, it just sounds so... And this is probably isn't an appropriate word to use, but just so unfair and so unjust.
Well, that's how I feel, and that's why when you're talking with people, because even though we're having this conversation and there's listeners that hopefully are becoming a bit more sensitive to Indigenous people, there's also other people that have gone through this experience who haven't made those steps, and it is very painful, and you've got to have support. And to me, I don't think there's enough support mechanisms, you know, out there within not only the Koori community but the wider community to deal with it. It can be very confrontational, and there is a lot of anger, and I see that anger in so many people, Aboriginal people that have gone through what I've gone through, you know, and you think, well, how can I be of assistance? You can't go around and hold, you know, 100,000 people, but you can say to them, well, look, okay, there are some people that you can talk with. It's not satisfactory. I mean, I've got a goal. I've got a 10-year plan where I'd like to see a centre established where Kooris and non-Kooris, you know, can be together and start dealing with what the stolen generations have gone through. I mean, okay, we've got an organisation called Link Up, but as someone that's gone through the process, as someone that's aware that Aboriginal kids are still being taken away from their families. And the whole thing is, you know, when I was born, we didn't have the Aboriginal organisations that exist today. We didn't have, like, the Victorian Aboriginal Child Care Agency or the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. And yet, even though these community-based organisations exist, you've got attitudes, say, for example, of a hospital liaison officer, a hospital social worker, who can look at somebody and say, well, you can pass... as a white person, they might even, you know, look at you and say, oh, well Ruth, yeah, it's fine, you know, she's got a child, she can't look after it, we'll just, you know, take the child away, and won't acknowledge her heritage because they think, well, you know, she doesn't look Aboriginal. Anyway, the child would be better off away from her, from their people, mm-hmm. which, and then so you know predictably that in 5 years' time, in 20 years' time, you're going to have another person like me sitting here with a person like you. I want that to stop.
That white people in Australia don't understand why it is so important for Aboriginals to embrace their heritage.
Right, well, and again, we're on Aboriginal land here, and I can bandy out around a term called terra nullius, which means empty land. So Ruth and I aren't really having a conversation because I don't exist. Indigenous people don't exist in this country, and that is a lie. We have to have land rights, we have to have sovereignty. I don't want to go in and say, well, what does land rights mean to you? I can assure you that it doesn't mean that we're looking at somebody's house and they're having a barbecue on a Sunday and they're lounging around by their swimming pool and someone's polishing the Volvo and we'll say, okay, we'll put a land claim on that. I mean, the trivialisation of land rights, again, to me reflects a lack of understanding of Indigenous people. And what does it mean? It's hard to explain because prior to the invasion, and I'll use that term, I won't be nice and say the settlement, because it wasn't a settlement. It is in the white history books, but it's not in our history books. There were over 700 individual nations here, 700 countries. And I'm looking at the television today and I'm looking and thinking, gee, what's going on in the world? All these wars. But the wars have never stopped. The only difference between the wars over in Europe is that they've been declared. But here in this country, there's an undeclared war. And it's going on. You know. But then I get excited too, and some of the listeners, you know, might understand what I mean, when, because we've been here since, you know, at least 100,000 years, there used to be intertribal warfare, and it's still going on. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but I get a real buzz that I think, wow, you know, you can take us away from our family, you know, you can feed all this education stuff in our heads and, you know, you can be racist, you can bash us up, you can rape us, you can, you know, sexually abuse our kids, you know, you can turn black people against black people, which is really bad, but it you know, that's all part of divide and conquer. But there's some things that are constant, you know, and other constant things like having strong black women in a community that hold the community together and having some strong black men that watch over what we do, that pull people aside and have a bit of a yarn and say, okay, nice weather we're having, but we think that, you know, we better look at our behaviour and behave in a responsible manner.
Well, finally, Lisa, what is it like for you today as a woman and as a Koori living in Australia?
Well, I love being a woman. I love being an Indigenous woman. I call myself an Indigenous black feminist. Of course, we can talk for hours on that. It's a struggle at times, particularly if you make yourself a little bit vulnerable. Vulnerable in the sense that, you know, I don't feel threatened by this interview, but, you know, you might give a public lecture. You know, you might go to a community college and talk, you know, politics or have ideas or tell a few jokes. And because racism and sexism does exist in this community, I mean, exist in Australian society, but it also, sadly, for some Indigenous people, you know, supposedly they adopt the patriarchal system, then they can oppress Koori women. I'm proud of who I am, and I'm strong, and I'm going to be around for a long time, and us women, you know, we're going to get together and we're going to sort things out. That's Indigenous women, but, you know, if we need to call on our other sisters, that's our non-Indigenous sisters, we'll be calling on you. Just on that last point, sometimes it's difficult, you know, because the overall struggle is the liberation of Indigenous people, black people. But at the same time, when we are liberated, then the rest of society will be liberated. And until that happens, you know, I'm going to be around. I'm going to be a strong black woman with my other sisters. We'll take time out every now and then, but we're going to be around.
Lisa Belair, and she's one of the contributors to Breaking Through, Women, Work and Careers, edited by Jocelyn Scutt and published by Artemis. It retails for $14.95. And my thanks to Lisa Belair for speaking to me.
That That was Lisa Belair speaking in 1992 with Ruth Barney from the Women on the Line program. You're listening to an episode of the five-part series Black Gold. Produced in the studios of 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Black Gold uncovers and celebrates the rich Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander contributions to radio across four decades.
Sounds of survival. This song is about sounds of survival.
Get the picture, Mary Mata.
It's called Koori Woman. It's for all the Kooris in the audience.
Gee, I can't see anyone.
That was Koori Woman by Titus. Coming up next, you'll hear more poetry readings from Lisa Belair. You'll also hear commentary from the 3CR Live Outside broadcast from back in 1990 when Nelson Mandela visited Melbourne.
People are standing up. One day they'll be clapping an Aboriginal person like this.
As you can hear, Nelson Mandela and the entourage have arrived into the town hall, and we'll probably be pretty well handing over to the MC Robin Archer from here on in. But
okay, well, my final comment is, don't forget, this is a great moment, but You're on Aboriginal land. Pay the rent. Land rights now.
Well, this is supposed to be reconciliation. A couple of weeks ago, I took a class at La Trobe University, Bundoora, and I actually had to go and look up a dictionary. It was Macquarie's dictionary, and I looked up reconciliation, and when I looked at it, I thought, oh, I don't really like that. And then I looked at reconcile, and I looked at that, and I thought, oh, I don't really like that either. But I thought, no, I'm not going to think of another term at this point in my career other than I think reconciliation. If you do open a Macquarie dictionary or another dictionary, have a look at it and think maybe from your perspective, and you think, well, maybe from another perspective of someone that doesn't have a say, and then ask yourself, oh, this word reconciliation, is it a good word or not? A bridge to reconcile. I walked across a bridge once, a bridge for reconciliation. Gee, I felt good. Decorated with a United Flag badge. Australian and Aborigine. Gosh, I felt proud. Had my image captured next to a smiling, reconciled Aborigine. Well, that's what the byline said. I walked across a bridge once and kept walking. Dedicated to all those people who walked once for reconciliation, especially during 2000. Shame to all of you who have never walked, marched with us again. Shame on you who walked once and don't come along to the National Sorry Day celebrations. I wrote a poem. This is inspired by Jiaoqi and Heart to Heart. From you to me to you from me, it's a start, heart to heart. Could the dream of sovereignty become reality, heart to heart? Could be a start, you and me, understanding sovereignty. Heart to heart, listen, could be a start, heart to heart. And that's a little Jiaoqi there. Just over there, here, ladies and gentlemen.
That was a poetry reading by Lisa Belair, Heart to Heart, from the CD of the same name. Coming up next, you'll hear audio excerpts from 3CR's weekly current affairs program, Women on the Line. This audio was originally broadcast on International Women's Day in 1997, produced by Karen James in conversation with broadcasters Lisa Belair and Kim Neville.
I think we need to take it a step prior to the racist attacks. I would say that, in general, the women's movement, if there is such a broad concept, hasn't dealt adequately at all with the racist attacks. Not only that, it's just a matter of a lot of feminists still won't even engage with Indigenous women. In 1994, I wrote my master's thesis on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women and non-Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women working together, and I was considered a radical because I dared write a 22,000-word thesis, which I've since gone on and passed. So I want to thank my feminist supervisors for all their support. But the ideas that I was talking about was racism, was land rights, was educational programs, was listening, respect. And it's kind of like, well, how many words do we have to keep writing? How many poems, how many songs, how many radio programs? I would say on an individual basis, I can name feminists, women who are part of the feminist movement, white middle-class women who are very, very supportive of us as Indigenous people. But just because someone says they're a feminist, I don't feel safe to think, oh, they're a feminist, they'll be okay by me as an Indigenous person. And that makes me a little bit sort of, you know, sad.
Are non-Indigenous feminists recognising and respecting, two of the words you just used a minute ago, the authority of Indigenous women, and are we learning to build solidarity?
Look, I just feel a little bit hesitant about the word, you know, authority, because I guess some people are held up as an authority, but I guess another way to rephrase that would be that there are times when, in spite of all the barriers that are put between Indigenous women, we're talking about women here, so let's talk about Indigenous women. We can, you know, include it to others as well. Often we don't even, you know, get a chance to, you know, have a cup of tea with each other, you know, and it's like, well, if we can't even do that, then why should we not be surprised when sometimes women who are in power aren't listening or working towards Indigenous women's issues? And I must say that I've had there's a term called exclusion by inclusion. And that's a term that comes from North America, and it basically that means that yes, we want to have an Aboriginal woman or an Indigenous woman or woman of colour have an opinion. So therefore, we've given you some space. Now just go away and be happy, you know. And that's something that we have to work through. I want to be positive about the future. I mean, this is sort of like a last effort for me coming on and talking on this show with you, Karen, because I'm absolutely fed up, and I'm just sticking, you know, to women I know, and I'm hanging around the UQ women's area at the University of Queensland and the Melbourne Uni women's area, because I know that that's one place every woman can go and not get hassled or questioned or have to cop racism. You know, people will have to go through a bit of soul searching, but like I like to qualify that, well, go through that process, but to Anglo women in particular, we don't have 15 years for you to do a PhD on us as women of colour and racism. There are practical things, like, you know, for a start, tune into radio programs, go to art galleries, hear the musicians, go to a couple of poetry readings. I know that you can go on and on and on the poetry reading. There's all these little pockets of communicating, having imposed colonial structures. This is a colonised country, so it's not only Indigenous people that are affected by those processes. It's everybody in this country. And I must mention the year 1967, May the 27th, that was when we had a referendum in this country. And the two things that people tick yes to the box was, one, to include Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the 1971 census, but it also gave the federal government overriding responsibilities for Aboriginal affairs. Now, we can say, what does that mean? And that's a rhetorical question. But this year, on May 27th, is the 30-year celebration. So as women, as lesbians, of women of colour, of people, women from all over this country, whatever background, are we going to celebrate May 27th, 1997, or is it just going to come and go and say, look, you've missed another opportunity? There are opportunities all the time, and we come round to International Women's Day, and it's like, how many years are we going to have to say what we've been saying? You know, I just want to curl up and just stick with my mates, you know. And I, as I said, I've been a little bit fed up and disillusioned. Normally, I'm an optimistic person. I have to say, at the moment, for the past 6 months, I've been ambivalent about my feminism. We haven't touched on the new wave feminism, but all I can say is, with these younger people, I am absolutely appalled, disgusted, how they do not mention women of colour. They don't mention racism, and you've got young Australian women, and one person's in the Australian Democrats who I quite admire, but I've never heard her mention racism. Natasha, and I'm disappointed with that, Naomi Wolf, and it's like all these white women are thinking, you're given a chance to speak, and 30 years later, we're off the map again. Looking back after sort of being involved in feminism, I think, you know, even though I'm ambivalent now, I've thought about feminism, you know, since I was little. I must say that since I've been young, and I continue to have role models, people that, one, a woman in particular, Susan Ryan, who was involved in the Sexual Discrimination Act, and women like Quinton Bryce, who is also celebrates Susan Ryan. It's important that we acknowledge women that have gone before. That's only two. My academic mentor, Dale Spender, has helped me get through, but she's also been criticised whenever she's raised issues of race, depending on the circles that she's in. It's like, well, what are you doing talking about racism? What are you doing challenging our course guides? You know, to please kindly go, you know, can you just go away? And I look to the younger women and hanging around Queensland University, that's very reassuring for me, because you think, well, look, these young women, these are our future. I mean, they're everybody's future. They've got the, you know, they've got the spirit, but they've also got to learn how to cope with banging their head against not just a brick wall, like a plutonium wall. That's what it is. But, you know, my advice is, look, smile, write to people that you admire or you like. Hopefully you can continue links. So like with Susan Ryan, she's just given me permission to give the speeches that she's given to me on women in parliament and women in activism to the UQ U Women's area at Queensland University. And I kind of think, I get a real buzz, because I think, look, she was out there fighting 25, 30 years ago, and here she is. She's involved with the next generation, and I'm trying to educate, you know, these women here. Look, okay, there's all this stuff going on, and I get real, real wild, and I'm wild now. I'm cheering up now that I've had a chance to talk, because that's the other thing. We don't often get asked our opinions. It's always someone outside. I don't say that someone who isn't Indigenous and urban can't speak on my behalf, but it's funny, when they're talking about silencing and political correctness, it's none of us yapping away, or we haven't got other people, because it's not just us. I mean, it's fortunate, you know, that we can have a bit of a yarn, you know, all together with you too, Karen. And I must say that even at broadcasting level, there's all things that we can do. I mean, even just having this bit of yarn, I mean, I appreciate it.
My sister's apron, and this was inspired by a photograph, I would think, taken in the early 1900s down at Lake Tyres. And this image has been identified at the Lake Tyres Aboriginal Mission, and a photograph of four Aboriginal women wearing aprons. Well, three of them had aprons on. My sister's apron. We ran about in pairs. Hey, the four of us. From that white fellow missionary, always mixing me and my cousins up, and sometimes we teased him real good. Tuesday we wash our aprons because on Wednesday the government photographer is coming. I can't be bothered with all the fuss. Not like my aunties, all excited. All us girls have to dress proper. We are representing our race. Too much politic for me. Stand in line, no touching. Sounds like the missionary's wife bossing us around. That's my cousin, my younger sister. She's the one without the apron on. The apron. Too late, we are scolded. Our images are now immortalised. I think of my sister's apron and laugh about the trouble she will be in.
That was a poetry reading by Lisa Belair, My Sister's Apron. And before that, you also heard Lisa Belair in conversation with producer Karen James and broadcaster Kim Neville from the program Women on the Line. Thank you to 3CR presenter Viv Malo. You've been listening to Black Gold, a five-part series unearthing some of our finest audio from across four decades in the 3CR archives. The Black Gold series was produced in the studios of 3CR Community Radio on Wurundjeri land in Fitzroy, Melbourne, by myself, Kerry Lee Harding, and assistant producer Corey Green. We would like to thank Bart Willoughby and the late Ross Hannaford for the music featured in this series, lifted from the album Buckskin. The series was financially supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks so much for listening, and if you'd like to listen again or find out more about this unique series, head to 3cr.org.au/blackgold. I look forward to your company next time. See you later.
This will be our last song for this bracket. Yeah, there's some more great artists coming up. A song called So Young. we'll see you later on.